we commit our ways to you and just look forward to our time together. Amen. So this essay is called Outdoor Fires. It begins with a quote from the Talmud, this tractate, one of three tractates on civil law. Rabbi Elazar would give a coin to a pauper, and only then he would pray. So the Holy Temple in Jerusalem was a human-like structure. Its chambers and furnishings corresponded to the various organs and faculties that make up the human being. As our sages point out, when God tells Moses, "They shall make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell within them," God does not say, "I will dwell within it," but within them. In other words, the objective of the Holy Temple is that we are aware, that we apply the awareness and experience of the divine which pervaded this physical edifice to all aspects of our daily life. So each of the temple's vessels and services which were performed with them has its equivalent in the manner in which we live our life and serve our Creator. The services performed in the tabernacle fall under two general categories. The inner services performed in the Heichal, the sanctuary. These included lighting the menorah, burning the ketoret, the incense, on the inner altar, arranging the showbread, and the rarefied service performed on Yom Kippur in the temple's innermost chamber, the Holy of Holies. The outer services performed in the Azarah, the temple courtyard, here were brought the korbanot, the animal and meal offerings, which were offered on the outdoor altar. On the individual level, this translates into two basic domains of human endeavor: our inner spiritual development, and B, our efforts to refine our material self and our involvements with other people and with the world around us. Common wisdom would dictate that we should proceed from the inside outward. First, we should deal with the internal needs of our soul, following which we can direct our attention to external matters. Having achieved inner harmony and perfection, we would be in the position to truly influence our surroundings. Tend to the home fires, we often tell ourselves, before concerning ourselves with the illumination of the outside. But in the Holy Temple, there were things were done the other way around. The day began by lighting the fire on the outer temple, which stood in the temple courtyard. In fact, the law specifically stipulates that both the inner altar and the menorah, which stood inside the sanctuary, are to be lit from the fires of the outer altar. This from the tractate on Yom Kippur in the Talmud. The menorah's seven oil lamps represented the divine wisdom of the Torah. The inner altar corresponds to the refinement and perfection of our higher spiritual faculties. But spiritual gluttony is no less selfish than the physical sort, and one who focuses solely on self-realization and self-fulfillment, even in the most positive and lofty sense, is turning their temple inside out. It is true that the more we possess, the more we have to give others. It is also true that when we are lacking in a certain area, it is extremely difficult to rectify such a failing in our fellow. Yet certainly the needs of others cannot be ignored until such time as we have obtained perfection ourselves. Furthermore, we often find that in reaching out to others, the primary beneficiary is oneself. An idea explained to others is now more fully and deeply understood. Helping another in a crisis opens up reserves of faith and fortitude in oneself that one hardly knew existed. This is the lesson implicit in the fact that the menorah and the inner altar were lit from the fire out in the courtyard. Reach out to others, to the other within yourself, that is your material self, and to the literal others to whom you can contribute some light and warmth. These external acts of illumination will, in turn, ignite the home fires of your own temple's inner chambers. Okay? So, it's a relatively short essay, but he certainly emphasizes and makes the point regarding the balance that we must come to terms with in our lives between the nourishment with which we sustain our heart, our spirit, and our ability to share some of the things that the Lord has given us with others, right? So it's important that we kind of apply both of these in our relationship with God and in our relationship with others. So we're going to talk about a few details from his comments. In other words, the objective of the Holy Temple is that we apply the awareness and experience of the divine which pervaded this physical edifice to all aspects of our lives. This passage from John 2 is a passage that we have discussed before. But the reason why it's so important is because in the Gospel of John, as we look at this passage, the Judeans confronted Yeshua by asking him, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove that you have the right to do all of this?" Yeshua answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again." The Judeans, by the way, this is the complete Jewish Bible. All other translations say Jews, but it wasn't Jews. I mean, it was Jews, but it was Judean Jews, right? So these are Jews who regarded themselves as particularly spiritual because they live in the environs of Jerusalem and participated in, actively in the services at the temple and not only the holiday services, but the regular services that took place and there was a synagogue on the Temple Mount where people gathered. So these are Judeans, not just Jews. At any rate, they say it took 46 years to build this temple and you're going to rebuild it in 3 days. But notice in verse 21, but the temple he had spoken of was his body. Right? So he wasn't talking about destroying the temple and rebuilding it in 3 days. I mean, that would have been impossible for someone to do, right? It took the nation 46 years to build it. But what's important about this passage has to do with the fact that Yeshua is using the word temple metaphorically, in this case of himself. So it shouldn't come as any surprise when the Rebbe, in his essay, associates the temple with us too, right? Because we are like a temple of God. Our temple also has inner chambers and outer chambers. The inner chambers being the chambers of the Yetzer Tov, right? And the outer chambers being the chambers of the Yetzer Hara, the various instincts which drive us, right? But the fact of the matter is that we are kind of a balance, like the temple is, with both, right? We have a inner being, which is, connected to God, and we have an outer manifestation, which is what people see and experience as we interact with them physically, right? Something else that's important about this particular passage, therefore, when he was raised from the dead, his Talmudim, his disciples, remembered that he had said this, and they trusted in the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, in what Yeshua had said. Now, while Yeshua was in Jerusalem, at the Pesach festival, the Passover festival, there were many people, notice who it says, believed in his name when they saw the miracles he performed, but he did not commit himself to them, for he knew what people are like. That is, he didn't need anyone to inform him about a person because he knew what was in a person's heart. And, of course, this statement is a remez to various passages in the Tanakh that speak of the fact that only God knows the heart. The devil doesn't know the heart. Only God knows the heart. Even angels don't know the heart, right? So this is a remarkable statement, frankly, to affirm this truth that Yeshua knew what was in a person's heart, a quality that can only be shared with God, right? Typically, we can only tell what's in a person's heart when they tell us, right? So that's true of expressing things in a way that the enemy hears or angels hear or others hear, right? But since we're under no obligation to reveal information to an enemy, then the devil isn't someone that you should be talking to, because he will use the information against you, as will any enemy you have. At any rate, this expression, believed in his name, what does this mean? That people believe that his name was Yeshua? Is that what it means? Because the expression doesn't make sense in English. It makes perfect sense in Hebrew, but not so much in Greek either, right? What possible significance could that have? That people came to believe that his name was Yeshua. Mazel tov, that's great. You know, you remembered who he is and what his name is, right? That's sometimes a challenge for us, right? But the statement doesn't really make sense. The expression is a Hebrew idiom that means many people believed who he was, right? That's what it means to believe in his name, to know who he is, right? So the word name in Hebrew does not mean what it means in Greek and in English. It means something very, very different. At any rate, this passage from 1 Corinthians chapter 6 also speaks of this. I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything. You say food for the stomach and the stomach for food, and God will destroy them both. The body, however, is not meant for sexual immorality, which is Paul's term for idolatry, because of the type of idolatry that that this type of sexual activity was characterized by, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. But by his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Messiah himself? Shall I then take the members of Messiah and unite them with a pagan temple prostitute? Never. Right? Now, notice the temple prostitute, which is what this prostitute is. This prostitute isn't just any prostitute. This prostitute is a pagan temple prostitute, and it's connected to the expression sexual immorality that he uses earlier, right? Sexual immorality for Paul was engaging in sexual relations with a temple prostitute in order to ensure the fertility of one's fields, the birth of a child, you know, success in business, whatever it might be, right? Fertility. But the fact is, Paul says never. Do you not know that he unites himself with a prostitute, a pagan temple prostitute, is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh. A remez to the passage in Genesis that speaks of Adam and Eve becoming one flesh. But whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Therefore, flee from sexual immorality and other sins a person commits outside the body. And whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. All of this is in the context of idolatry. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have received from God? Therefore, you are not your own. You were bought with a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. Ancient Corinth was one of the largest and most important cities in ancient Greece, around the year 400 before the Common Era. In 146, it was captured and completely destroyed by the Roman army. But as a newly rebuilt Roman colony in 44, Corinth flourished and became the administrative capital of the Roman province of Achaia. This next comment, the command to flee, in verse 18, flee sexual immorality, the command to flee is urgent and decisive, suggesting immediate and complete separation from idolatry. Right? Now, one of the remarkable things about this is this happens to be a Christian commentary, so I was happy to see that this author recognized what the sexual immorality in this passage from 1 Corinthians chapter 6 actually is, right? At any rate, he goes on to say, in the context of Corinth, a city known for its numerous temples and pagan practices, idolatry was a pervasive temptation. The cultural and religious environment included the worship of gods like Aphrodite, or to the Romans, Venus, who is the goddess of love, beauty, pleasure, and procreation. And, of course, there were temples to Apollo there as well, which often involved rituals and feasts that believers were tempted to participate in. This echoes the Hebrew Bible warnings against idolatry, such as in Exodus 20, where God commands exclusive worship. The call to flee is not just a physical departure, but a spiritual and moral distancing from anything that compromises one's devotion to God. This aligns with a broader biblical narrative that portrays idolatry as spiritual adultery, a theme seen in books like Hosea. The apostolic writings further reinforces this in passages like 1 John, where believers are urged to keep themselves from idols. So it's an interesting phenomenon that there are many references in the apostolic epistles to idolatry and fleeing from idolatry, but not a single word in the Gospels about idolatry, because idolatry was primarily a phenomenon that the Gentile believers brought into the community. And, of course, people like Paul and Peter and Timothy and Titus, John, other authors, have to address issues like this because people don't change overnight. I mean, it would be nice if we did, but the fact of the matter is we don't, right? I mean, I just turned 74 a few days ago, and frankly, I am still a long way from whatever objective God has called me to personally, right? In terms of this inner sanctuary aspect of the Rebbe's comments, right? I mean, there is still a good deal of work to be done. Hopefully not as much as there was 40 years ago, but, you know, I, like everyone else, is still a long way off. One of the other comments, I apologize for going back to this, but if you look at this statement in verse 15 of 1 Corinthians 6, do you not know that your bodies are members of Messiah himself? If your bodies are members of Messiah himself, that's expression that is sometimes used, what would Messiah do, is very relevant Right. I mean, if we are members of Messiah, did Messiah observe Shabbat? He did indeed. Did Messiah celebrate the holidays? He did indeed. Did Messiah eat matzah for the week of Passover? He did indeed. Right? Did Messiah build a sukkah for the week of Sukkot? He did indeed. Right? He was immersed in the way that people are, you know, when they have to be purified or made clean before they take whatever steps lead up to the temple, mount the temple platform. I mean, but the character of his life was Torah observant. You would think that based upon passages like this, that people would appreciate the fact that just as the Messiah was Torah observant in his life, we should be Torah observant in ours. I'm not I don't completely understand, you know, why that distinction for believers occurs. Obviously, it was the work of the church fathers who succeeded very successfully in their effort to separate the church from the synagogue. At any rate, number two, on the individual level, this translates into the two basic domains of human endeavor, our inner spiritual development, and B, our efforts to refine our material self and our involvements with other people and with the world around us. So here's a comment that's I thought was important to include. Why is it so hard to be good? It is a question that Jewish thinkers have been asking for more than 1,000 years. While the commandments in the Torah and other Jewish texts are laid out pretty clearly, people often have a hard time following them. Musar, also spelled with one S, is a spiritual practice that gives concrete instructions on how to live a meaningful and ethical life. It arose as a response to this concern. Musar is virtue-based ethics, based upon the idea that by cultivating inner values, inner virtues, we improve ourselves. This is in contrast to most Jewish ethical teachings, which are rule-based. Today, a number of people who do not follow traditional Jewish rules and rituals are attracted to Musar because it offers opportunities for personal transformation through a Jewish lens. Musar masters recognize that simply learning about kindness does not make us more kind. Moreover, they understood that our inner drives, wounds, and appetites often manifest as the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, actively preventing us from behaving as we know we should, something Paul talks about in his letter to the Romans. One Musar teacher, Rabbi Elia Lopian, described Musar as teaching the heart what the mind already understands. The word Musar appears in the Bible 51 times, more than half of them in the book of Proverbs. It carried a connotation of ethical instruction according to the teachings of the Torah. In the rabbinic period, texts such as Pirkei Avot carried the thread of personal ethical teachings. In the medieval period, Musar became a branch of study focused on virtue ethics as opposed to rule-based ethics, the practice of working to refine one's character to become a better person and closer to God. So, one observation, virtue ethics is an approach to ethics that emphasizes an individual's character as the key element of ethical teaching or thinking, rather than rules about the acts themselves, deontology, or their consequences, consequentialism, right? But rules-based ethics is deontology, right? Where you learn the rule with regard to being kind and the expectation that because you are aware of the rule, you are supposed to act in a way that satisfies what the instruction requires, right? So you can see that virtue ethics is very different. I mean, obviously, it's still based upon Torah ethics, Torah teaching, Torah principles. It's not as if it's out there by itself. But the fact is that it is a way of emphasizing a different approach to coming to terms with who we are and how we can become better at what we do. By the way, the character qualities or values that are emphasized in Musar, and I'm just going to go through these quickly for sake of time, but if you have any interest in any of this, if you look at the fourth footnote, there are three books on Musar, if you have any interest. Alan Morinis, who is a leader in the Musar movement, he has written a book, Everyday Holiness, The Spiritual Path of Musar. Barry Blockland and Alan Morinis, The Musar Torah Commentary, A Spiritual Path to Living a Meaningful and Ethical Life, which is an interesting resource based upon the Torah and the weekly Torah portion. Ruchi Koval, Soul Construction, Shape Your Character, Using 8 Steps from the Timeless Jewish Practice of Musar. Of course, there are dozens of other books too, but these are a good resource if you're interested. At any rate, the character qualities are humility, patience, gratitude, compassion, order. Notice the Hebrew word for order is Seder, right? That's why we refer to the celebration of Passover when we do the Seder, right? We do it in an orderly way. We follow a prescribed order in the celebration of Passover. But self-control, menuchat ha-nefesh, this is an interesting expression too, because menuchat means resting, right? So self-control is a resting of the soul, a calmness of the soul. In other words, it's acting in rational, not emotional ways, right? The Hebrew expression is interesting. Honor, simplicity, enthusiasm, silence. Here's another one that's mentioned frequently in Paul's letters. Shtika, silence. And obviously silence is not silence, right? What is silence? If silence is not talking, which is what it isn't, when Paul refers to women should be silent, for example, the word silent in Hebrew doesn't mean not to talk. In Isaiah 53, it says the Messiah will be silent when he is led to the sacrifice. But he wasn't. He talked, but he was silent. He talked and was silent at the same time. Because silence in Hebrew is a peaceful quality. It's a calmness. It's a trusting God in such a way so that there is no anxiety, right? It's a peaceful state before God, waiting on the Lord. At any rate, generosity, truth, moderation, loving kindness, the Hebrew word chesed, responsibility, trust, the word faith is emunah, trust is the word is bitchon, and yirah, awe. Unfortunately, no English translation of yirah is accurate, but we typically translate the word as fear or awe. Gentiles who fear God, for example, this word is used of them. At any rate, from this passage in 2 Corinthians, so from now on we regard no one from a worldly point of view. Though we once regarded Messiah in this way, we do so no longer. Therefore, if anyone is in Messiah, the new creation has come. The old has gone, the new is here. All this is from God, who reconciled us to himself through Messiah and gave us the ministry of reconciliation, that God was reconciling the world to himself in the Messiah. So this is something we play a role in, the reconciling of the world, not counting people's sins against them. And he has committed to us the message of reconciliation. We are therefore Messiah's ambassadors, as though God were making his appeal through us. We implore you on Messiah's behalf, be reconciled to God. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. And there are several passages that address this. I'm just going to make a comment about them because I'm running out of time, okay? In Ephesians, we're called to do good works, right? So the word for works, of course, is the word mitzvot, commandments, instructions. So this is among the many, many statements by Paul that we are supposed to walk in God's ways, not dismiss them as irrelevant. This passage in Ephesians 5, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of the light, right? For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, and find out what pleases the Lord. And this passage from Colossians, right, notice that this passage speaks about the cancellation, but not of the Torah. The Messiah in his death canceled the charge of our legal indebtedness, right? He didn't cancel the Torah. That's a completely nonsensical notion, right? What he did was cancel the charges against us, the sin that results in our death. He canceled death for us, right? So that's what's so remarkable about the work of Messiah. At any rate, number three, it is true that the more we possess, the more we have to give to others. It is also true that when we are lacking in a certain area, it is extremely difficult to rectify such a failing in our fellow, right? This passage from Luke 12 is a passage we talked about not too long ago about the certain rich man whose crops yielded an abundant harvest, right? So he has this great harvest. He has granaries that he can put this harvest into, but it doesn't all fit. So he thinks to himself, you know, this harvest is so great, I'm going to tear down my granaries and build bigger ones, right? The fact of the matter is that he dies the next day with all this grain and full granaries, right? But Yeshua ends this story by saying, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God, right? He shouldn't even have thought of tearing down his existing granaries and building others. He should have immediately imagined ways in which he could use the excess grain to benefit people in the community. But he doesn't, right? And this passage from Matthew 7 goes along with this statement that, you know, when it comes time to confronting a brother or a sister because of a speck in their eye. Here, you know, let me help you take that speck out of your eye. You know, Yeshua says, you know, before you attempt to take the speck out of someone else's eye, take the log out of your own. You know, that massive piece of timber out of your own eye. So you can see clearly enough to say something or do something in a meaningful way, right? Which is what this passage from the Rebbe says. It is also true that when we are lacking in a certain area, it is extremely difficult to rectify such a failing in our fellow, right? I mean, if we are struggling with something, it's a little incongruous to identify that same failing in our life, in the life of someone else, and counsel them how to fix it, right? I mean, but that's what often happens. At any rate, number four, furthermore, we often find that in reaching out to others, the primary beneficiary is oneself. An idea explained to others is now more fully and deeply understood. This is something that I have always clung to, right? The idea that explaining something to others helps me understand it in a way that perhaps I really didn't. And you have probably discovered that too, right? That as concepts and ideas become clearer and clearer to you, your ability to communicate them with others increases, right? And in some cases, talking about them with others is a way of clarifying in your own heart what it is you're trying to come to terms with, right? So there is no such thing as a trivial conversation about biblical issues, right? There is nothing that we can't talk about, because it's the talking, it's the working through details, it's the process that helps us come to terms with what it is we should believe. At any rate, helping another in a crisis opens up reserves of faith and fortitude in oneself that one hardly knew existed, right? And you've probably discovered that this is true as well. What's interesting about this concept is the Hebrew word natan. It means to give, to put, or to set. But notice that it's spelled the same way, forward and backward. The word natan, the Hebrew word natan, notice it as a noon, a tav, and a final noon, right? But the final noon is only shaped like this because it comes at the end of the word. So the spelling of natan is noon, tav, noon, right? It reads the same forward and backward. And this indicates, in rabbinic thought, that in giving, one also receives, right? So it makes the concept of giving even more compelling, the idea that as we give, we also get. Right now, I'm not suggesting that we should give to get, right? But it is kind of a benefit, right? That is built in to the spelling of a Hebrew word, in this case, for example. So this brings me to something that I came to, reflections on crisis and human resilience. If you notice, the footnote is to a software. It's called Notion.com. Roderick introduced me to this software. We were playing with it when he and I spent some time together. Notion.com is a site that employs artificial intelligence, right? So what's interesting is that you can ask Notion.com, you can ask it a question, and it will respond. When Roderick and I were together, we were talking about some of the inconsistencies in the way, or the difference between what Paul meant when he said something and the way the vast majority of Christians understand it, right? So, Roderick typed this question into the, into the little search bar. And what's interesting is that Notion.com came back with an explanation of what Paul meant when he wrote what he wrote, and the peculiar circumstance regarding the way that text is understood. You know, it's interesting that artificial intelligence understood what Paul was saying, and furthermore, understood the way the text was twisted to suggest what it means to the vast majority of people who read it, right? I mean, it was amazing. So I tried it. I happened to use it this week. Reflections on Crisis and Human Resilience. In times of crisis, the human spirit reveals its most profound dimensions. When we extend ourselves to help others during their darkest moments, we discover hidden strengths within ourselves, right? So this is a comment that the artificial intelligence makes, and it is identical to what the Rebbe says. It's interesting. Our capacity for compassion expands when confronting others' challenges. Inner strength emerges most powerfully when supporting those in need. The act of helping creates a reciprocal strengthening of both helper and helped. Helping others doesn't just aid them, it reveals and strengthens our own inner resources, often surprising us with capabilities we never knew we possessed. When we reach out to help others, we tap into previously undiscovered personal strengths. Our perspective on human capability broadens. We build stronger community connections, and our own resilience grows through the experience. So these are important things to contemplate. And finally, reach out to others, to the other within yourself, that is your material self, and to the literal others to whom you can contribute some light and warmth, right? So there are various ways in the scripture in which we are directed, right, to practice our faith, our trust in God. One is from Matthew 5, you are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden, neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see, again, this expression, good deeds, right? Good mitzvot, and glorify your Father in heaven. And, of course, this passage from the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 6, be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others in order to be seen by them, right? We are called to practice our righteousness in front of others, but we're cautioned against doing it in order to be seen by others. If we do it with the express objective of acquiring the accolades of others, that will be the entire reward that we receive for doing something, right? In other words, if you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven, right? You got the applause of the observers, right? And so enjoy it, because that's as much reward as you're going to get if that's your objective, right? If it's not your objective, then it's obviously something very different. But notice in verse 2 of this passage, when you give to the needy, not if you give to the needy. In verse 3, when you pray, not if you pray. And, of course, prayer here is the Amidah, the prayer we say collectively as a community. In verse 16, when you fast, not if you fast. There are four fasts during the year that we participate in. They would have been fasts that Yeshua participated in as well. And he goes on to say in verse 19, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. How do you do that? By praying, by fasting, by giving to the needy, by reaching out to others, by having an impact in someone else's life. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. So we're going to stop there. It's a good place to stop on this idea that where our treasure is, there is our heart also, right? So it obviously isn't suggesting that we don't have any treasure here on earth, right? That we don't take advantage of whatever resources we have to, make ends meet after we stop working, for example, right? We do have to have some income to survive. So it's not suggesting that we, that we don't have any resources for us or resources for our family or families or whatever. But the fact of the matter is that our heart can't be consumed with those things. It has to be connected to whatever treasure is laid up in heaven. Okay, so comments, questions about anything we've discussed? David,
well, I wanted to ask you, with regard to the word natam that you had mentioned, that is read the same way forwarded back, I was wondering, the word sowing or planting and reaping and harvesting, in Hebrew, would that be true as well? Because when you do sow a seed, something is going to come back to you. You're going to reap a harvest.
That's true. I apologize. I can't think of those words off the top of my head. I would have to look them up. But one of the things that I can also tell you about Hebrew is that sometimes when a Hebrew word is spelled one way, it means a particular thing. And when it's spelled the other way, it means the opposite. Right? So that's something else which is very interesting about the way Hebrew works, is that there are many Hebrew words that spelled one way, spelled forward, mean a particular thing, and spelled backwards mean the opposite, right? So that may be the case with the words for sowing and reaping, for example. That may be the case. I'd have to look them up. So I can do that and let you know. Okay?
Okay, thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, what was the other one? Sowing and reaping?
Sowing and reaping, or planting and harvesting.
Yeah, planting, harvesting, yes.
And one other thing that you said that is very, very important, not to be consumed with trying to make a living and making ends meet and accumulating stuff. Because the thing is, if you get so consumed, you can get so consumed with making a living that you actually, you don't live life. You don't enjoy life. And when you're gone, somebody else is going to enjoy it for you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly true. And that, depending upon what one does for a living, that in some circumstances is easier to manage than in some professions than it is in others, right? For example, if you, you know, if you work a 9-to-5 job in an office, for example, right? I mean, you go to work at 9, you come home at 5, right? And your evenings, right, are what you do with your evenings are up to you, right? But, you know, if you're an FBI agent and you're on call, or a rabbi on call, or a fireman on call, if you have the kind of job that requires you to be available to people with needs at any time of the day or night, you know, then it's a lot more complicated to balance those details or aspects of your life. I agree. You know, and obviously there's a lot in between. You know, someone who has a regular schedule and you know, someone who doesn't, right? And frankly, it's helpful going in to a relationship, a marriage, with an awareness of these demands, right? Because they're not always accepted very, very well. Sometimes it can be very complicated, right? So, yeah, that's a great observation. Appreciate it. Thanks, David. Charlene, did you have your hand up?
I did accidentally, but I did have a question.
Too late.
Where it talked about, well, it's more like a comment, where it talked about the inner services and the outer services of the temple and being able to apply it, you know, our, the things that happen in the inner services and the outer services to our life. I never thought about it in that perspective. You know, because everything is, I'm really starting to just understand more, I think, you know, that there's two manifestations of us, the inner and the outer.
Yeah.
And it just helps me look at things differently.
Yeah. Absolutely. Me too. I mean, you know, it's one thing to appreciate that the earthly tabernacle, for example, is a reflection of the heavenly tabernacle. I mean, that kind of plays into the significance of, you know, the tabernacle too, but this this insight takes it to a different level, right? And what's I think what speaks to me is how deep Torah concepts are. I mean, you know, you have a pashat, a literal text that says a specific thing and obviously is supposed to be applied to our lives too. But there is such a richness when we plumb the depths of the Torah and explore concepts and ideas like this. It was after reading this essay that I thought more deeply about what Paul writes about being a temple of God ourselves, right? This idea, you know, that, I mean, it's not just you're a temple of God, mazel tov, you know, it's like, that's terrific. You know, give yourselves a hand, right? It's about what happens at the temple and how the temple works, right?
Yeah.
And what goes in to facilitating the activities associated with the temple also apply to our lives, right? It's pretty remarkable. I agree. Yeah, good. Good, good. Thank you. From Susanna, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Belated birthday wishes. Thank you. I understand mitzvot to mean a commandment. is it also a kind of deed, not necessarily obeying a commandment? A deed? Well, I mean, I think deeds are obeying commandments. I mean, I'm not sure I could think of a deed that wouldn't reflect an instruction in the Torah to do a particular thing, right? But a bit off topic, but I heard someone say both Israel and the church are the elect. Different roles, however. I'm thinking this is not true, however. Israel was chosen as God's elect to lead the nations. Sounds like something believers in Messiah would do too. So when Paul talks of God's elect, is he talking about believers and those grafted into Israel? Right? Since there is no church in the Bible, including the apostolic writings, the idea that Israel and the church are both the elect of God is inaccurate or incorrect, right? Now, believers, Gentile believers, are part of God's elect because they are grafted in to Israel, right? They are, like we read from what Paul writes in his passage to the Corinthians, do you not know that your bodies are members of Messiah himself? Right? So believers are part of the body of Messiah, right? They're connected to Israel. I must admit I'm confused by the way so many passages, texts in the apostolic writings that connect Gentile believers to Israel in terms of the connection to Israel's covenants, in terms of the connection to Israel's promises, in terms of the connection to Israel's mission, right? I'm at a loss to understand how it is that so many people imagine that God raised up a church in Israel's place, even though God says hundreds of times in the scripture that he has not rejected his people and never will, right? So you have to wonder how it was that a theology like that was so easily popularized, right? Because it is what the vast majority of Christians believe today. All, perhaps, that might be better to say all Christians believe. They're a part of a church, and the church is something that God raised up, a body of believers that God raised up to replace Israel. Right? I mean, even for evangelicals who still believe that God is doing something among his people, I wish I had a nickel for every pastor who described the great tribulation as taking place on earth between Israel and the nations, while the church is in box seats watching from heaven these events take place. So, there is no church in the Bible. They can't. The church is not the elect of God. Israel is the elect of God, and Gentiles who connect themselves to Israel, they're part of the elect of God. That's the way it works, right? They're grafted in. They're wild branches grafted in among the natural branches, right? So that's the way it works. So there are just so many passages that address this issue, speak to this issue. It's quite remarkable that so many people believe the exact opposite to be true. At any rate, when Paul talks about God's elect, he's talking about the people of Israel and the Gentile believers and Jewish believers, obviously, who are connected together, right? They're grafted in. They're grafted. The non-Jewish believers are grafted in among the Jewish believers, right? That's the way the olive tree works. Thank you, Susanna. Hope that makes sense. From Rivka, the last verse of our notes, storing up treasures in heaven rather than earth, was the very first memory verse I learned to say in front of the SDA church when it was the children's time on stage every Sabbath. That's a good memory to have. I'm curious to know how old you would have been at that time, but it is my special memory verse, and it's a great one. Yeah, it's one of the great ones. Also from Rivka, couldn't read yet, was 3 years old when a toddler moved into preschool. 3 years old when she memorized that verse and got up on stage and repeated it in front of the congregation. Very good. Okay, also from Susanna, thank you, Rivka. I can't help but just to share something. There's no way in the world I could have done something like that when I was 3 or 10 or 15 either. I was absolutely terrified of speaking in front of people when I was younger. It took a good deal to overcome it, right? But it's just interesting to see the ways in which the Lord can, you know, cultivate in us whatever it is that He, you know, expects us to be. At any rate, also, thank you, Rivka. Also from Susanna, not to be disrespectful, but unfortunately this person is a Jewish believer who, it sounds like, adopts some Christian theology or teaching. Right. I would say that they have adopted Christian theology and teaching, not some, right? So I would guess that this Jewish believer also believes in the evangelical model that most Christians employ. I would guess that they believe in the Trinity. I would guess that they believe in, you know, in the way, in baptism and the way baptism works, that when you get baptized, you have to be baptized by an officiant of the church, as opposed to baptism being something which is done by oneself, for oneself, right, with an attendant, you know, watching or, you know, kind of making sure that you get all the way underwater. I would guess that all of his theology is Christian. And unfortunately, that would be true for most of the Jewish believers involved in the Messianic movement today. Thank you for the clarification. Always learning makes so much sense when it comes from the Scripture, getting a little clearer. Thank you, Baruch Hashem. Thank you, Susanna. I appreciate you sharing that. Good. Anybody else before we go?
Oh, Rabbi, I was just going to say that when you were going through the list, the character qualities, values, and I'm thinking that's a long list. I can't remember all of it. And then what Yeshua said in Matthew 7 came to mind. Do unto others. And as I read through the list again after I was thinking about that verse, kind of helped me with that. I think I could, if I just remember that one,
yeah,
all the rest of this will come.
Yeah, that is an incredibly important one. Do unto others as you would have them do to you. Or, you know, the way Hillel puts it, don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. So regardless of how you phrase it, it is at the heart of our relationship with God and the way He expects us to relate to others, right? Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, your strength, right, your soul, your soul, your heart, your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Those, you know, that instruction, Ed, that you just quoted, right, is you know, is probably one of the most important summaries of the Torah that exists. Right? It's an incredibly important instruction. Not only in terms of the way we treat others, but the way, you know, the way we relate to God, we expect God to relate to us. You know, it's just big one. Good, very good.
Even to the inner self, too, I think. I mean, sometimes I have to tell myself to be kind to myself, trust myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a good all-around rule, I think.
It is.
Thank you for sharing that list.
Yeah, thank you. Good. By the way, this passage, that list that Ed just mentioned, the third one, is gratitude. Hakarat hatov. The word hakarat means to recognize the good. Hatov is the good. Recognize the good. That's what gratitude is. It's recognizing and appreciating the good that God accomplishes in our lives and being grateful for it. And good, of course, can also include bad that God uses for good in our lives, right? So gratitude is about everything we experience. As hard as that is to come to terms with sometimes, it's about everything God uses to cultivate, to mature us, to, you know, to grow us, you know, into the person he wants us to be. A lifelong pursuit. It's funny, Charlene wrote me a happy birthday greeting, and she, I hope this is okay to share, she said, I hope you had a great day. And I said, you know, the birthday was great, all except for the part that I'm 1 year older now. You know, something I didn't think about much when I was 21 and 31 and 41, but I do now.
So, Rabbi, you say you in your 70s?
74.
And you don't look it though, Rabbi.
Well,
you don't look in your 70s, man.
Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it. I have worked hard all my life, so that probably has something to do with it. But I can't do today what I could do then, that's for sure.
Well,
Ed, what's that?
I said you have a great level of energy. Really.
Well, when it comes to the Torah, certainly. Yeah, thanks, Keith. Ed and Charlene. David, anybody else before we go? Susanna, Rivka?
On number two, with the character qualities and values, I know you read them in English, but could you read them in the Jewish with the explanation?
Sure. Humility is anava. Patience is savlanut. Savlanut is a very important word. When you are in Israel and need people, when they're speaking to you in Hebrew, to talk more slowly, right? You want them to have more savlanut, more patience with you. Gratitude is hakarat hatov. Compassion is rachamim. You may be familiar with some of these. Rachamim is compassion. Order is seder. Self-control, menuchat ha-nefesh, the resting of the soul. Honor is kavod. Simplicity is histapkut. Enthusiasm is erizut. Silence is shtika. Generosity is nedivut. Truth is emet. Moderation is Shevil Hazahov. Loving kindness is Chesed. Responsibility is Achreyut. Trust is Bitchon. Faith is Emunah. And awe is Yirah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Pleasure. Okay. Thanks, Elaine. Let's see. Okay. There was another comment from Rivka. There it is. From Rivka. Gratitude. If they do these things in the green, what will they do in the dry? Complaining when there's nothing to complain about. Yeah, that's a good aspect of it too, right? Complaining when there's nothing to complain about. It's people that have a kind of a negative disposition, right? They tend to, you know, see that the calf is always half empty as opposed to half full, right? But, yeah, good. Thank you. We appreciate the additional explanation. Another message. Can you give an example of how one would follow a virtue rather than a rule in the Musar path teaching? What you would do with regard to, we'll take gratitude, for example. In the Torah, there is a passage in the description of the celebration of Sukkot where the instruction in the Torah is to rejoice before the Lord for 7 days. Right? So, a rules-based approach to the idea of rejoicing before the Lord for 7 days would have to do with the idea that God instructs us to rejoice so we may try to fulfill that obligation to celebrate Sukkot with rejoicing by doing things that change our mood, for example. We might sing songs. We might dance before the Lord. We might share stories because Sukkot is also a time when we invite visitors into the Sukkah. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, David, Moses, for example, and talk about their lives. And it's possible, as a result of doing that, that we can rejoice, right? But in Musar, the notion of rejoicing or expressing gratitude would have to do with trying to augment one's inner character, right? So in other words, it has to do with trying to bring oneself to a place where gratitude is more naturally expressed as a result of something that the Lord has accomplished in our lives, right? So, one approach says you're supposed to pray 3 times a day, and perhaps because of the instruction, you know, to pray 3 times a day, the morning, afternoon, and evening, perhaps that's the reason why Peter went to the rooftop of his friend's house in Joppa to pray, because he had grown up with the practice of praying each afternoon, right? So that would be a rule-based approach to ethical behavior, right? Whereas a value-based approach to ethical behavior would be to to pray, not because you have an obligation to, but because you want to, right? You think of it as interacting with God on a personal level, and not just reciting words, but allowing those words to impact your heart, right? I've mentioned this before, but in one of the synagogues that I attended in Southern California, there was a saying written out on the wall, right? It was like a plaque or a poster, and it was right at the entrance where you walk into the sanctuary. And it said, you know, the objective of prayer is to pray with kavanah. In other words, to pray with intention, with feeling, with devotion. In other words, the instruction was, when you come into the sanctuary, don't just recite words from memory while you're thinking about something else, right? I mean, everybody around you will imagine that you are praying, right, and doing a good job at it. But that's not really the point. The point is connecting with God. And together as a community, connecting with God, right? So only if we pray with kavanah can that connection actually take place. So that's the difference between going through the motions. And, you know, when someone does what they're supposed to do, that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? We use the expression going through the motions to refer to a process whereby one does something required of them but has no emotional investment in it, right? So that can apply to all kinds of things. I mean,
Rabbi, I think it is just like when you say praying with kavanah, and you could also say apply that to studying as well with the same intent. So not only prayer, but when you study, it should be for the same intent, not just to read, but to read for, to gain something and to get a, that's why we continue to go through the Torah cycles each year, because next year we'll be thanking someone else on something else as we read this. So
yeah.
One of the things I kept thinking about was the difference between the tabernacle and the temple. That's one of the things I was thinking about this Torah portion as I was reading, is is thinking of it that way will open up some things about it, because they were, the temple and the tabernacle were different as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the analogy is a good one too. I don't know about you, but I would not feel particularly comfortable flying in a plane, you know, with a pilot who had spent a considerable time learning how to fly a plane, but had not actually flown one, you know?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that would be like me saying, yeah, I can land this plane. I saw Top Gun. You know? Trust me. I saw Top Gun 6 times. I'm sure I can take care of this. Right? That's just obviously not how it works, but yeah. And you're also right with regards to the cycle, you know, I have and have always had this kind of hang up about saying the same things over and over and over and over again. I mean, obviously similar subjects come up and I do repeat certain things, but I could speak from the same notes, right, to a group of people, and both messages would be different, even though I was using the exact same notes to communicate it, right? I just wouldn't express it or communicate it in the same way, right? So there's an advantage to studying the Torah each annual cycle and being exposed to you know, various depths of insight from the Torah. That's like what Charlene mentioned earlier, right? It's, you know, after a time, the blessing is when you begin to see some of the depths beneath the surface on your own, right?
Yes. Well, one of the things as I was reading this Torah portion, and again, there's so much there, and I'm learning so much more each time, but I was like, they were very highly intelligent, because when you think of taking a kidney, when they dissect that, I have no clue what a kidney looks like, but they did.
Yeah.
And they were able to identify the different parts. And also, it the more and more I read scripture, the more and more I see how in depth and how intelligent they were during that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think we often underestimate their intelligence, right? We often imagine that they, you know, that they couldn't read, they couldn't write, they, you know, but they could. They could read and write. Not everybody could write, but they all could read. You know, and that was not true in many ancient cultures, but it was true of the people of Israel. Yeah, very good. Thanks, Keith. Let's see, there's a couple of other comments. This, I guess, gave the example, the difference between value ethics and rules ethics. Does this sort of follow the concept that both the letter and the spirit of the law go together to be meaningful? Yes, absolutely. Motive is important, not just going through the motions. Absolutely. Motive is important. But doing what the text says is important too, right? Doing what it says and doing it with the right heart. That's the key to, you know, to achieving something, right? Meaningful. This comment, thank you for all your patience with my questions. It's not a problem. This is what I'm here for. So one of the things it's the reason why we take this time together. So also from Rivka, is that focus with common prayer the reason, one of the reasons that having a blemish isn't permitted with the Levites doing a service? People who participated in the services at the temple, the priests, the Levites, right? Yeah, they could not be blemished. The priest who actually served their course in the temple could not have physical blemishes. There's probably a good deal that could be said about that, but I think in part it reflects the idea that even the service of the priests is to reflect the work of the Messiah, right? And the work of the Messiah was possible because the Messiah was without sin, right? So the priests, when they serve the Lord in the tabernacle or in the temple, they're supposed to be as clean and pure as it's possible for them to be. I mean, there may be other explanations as well, but that would be my understanding or take on it. Right? So it's not just about the sacrifice of the Messiah. What takes place at the tabernacle and the temple, everything reflects the glory of the work of Messiah. Yeah, good. Thank you. Rivka, anybody else before we go? good discussion. I'll have to look more carefully at this resource with regard to the Musar and the Musar Torah commentary. Who knows? Maybe we'll use that for next year. We'll see. I have several collections that we can, you know, use for our studies. Yeah, also Rivka mentions the people would be looking at the infirmary rather than focusing on the words of the prayers. Yeah, I'm sure that would be true, that if that there might be some issues depending upon, you know, whatever was going on in the life of the priest at the time. Good, thank you, Rivka. Just a comment from Suzanne. As I think of going through the book of Leviticus, I went to a funeral for a friend today, and during the Catholic Mass, I was wondering how the Catholic Church could usurp the priesthood. The Catholic Church usurped the priesthood by teaching that the priests who serve in the church, they follow in the footsteps of the Messiah, who was a priest according to the priesthood of Melchizedek, not Levi. Right, so the Levitical priesthood is inferior and is done away with in Catholic theology and Christian theology. The Levitical priesthood, the priesthood, the services at the temple, everything associated with the priesthood is done away with in the Messiah. Right? But in the Catholic Church, there needs to be some biblical basis for a priesthood, and so they usurp the priesthood of Melchizedek and apply it to the priesthood of the church with all of the, you know, all of the official functions that go along with it, right? Administering baptism, administering marriage, administering the death of a loved one, right? You have to have a priest for all of those things. In Judaism, you don't need a rabbi for any of those things. Yeah. Very good. Thanks, Susanna. Anybody else before we go? By the way, in the Senate... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, is the Musar a collection of like, writings and stuff?
It's a work. I think, let me see here, when we first talked about it. I didn't mention the... Yeah, it's a work which was originally authored, like, in the 14th century. And then, you know, various rabbis... including the one that's mentioned in this, one Musar teacher, Rabbi Elia Lopian, who lived in the 19th and 20th century, adds to it. So it is a work written by a rabbi in like the 14th century and then built upon or added to over time as other rabbis use that resource or explain it, right? They explain it, and then those explanations become a part of the Musar literature, right? That's the way a lot of things work. I mean, even the work Pirkei Avot, The Ethics of the Fathers, is a work associated with the Mishnah, the oral Torah, and the Talmud. But there are commentaries on Pirkei Avot that are now a part of what many people study when they study Pirkei Avot. They don't just read through it, right? They employ some of the commentary on Pirkei Avot, you know, to understanding its teaching. Yeah, good.
I found a couple of sites that talk about the Tsar. I just included a link for one of them. It's from My Jewish Learning, and it actually has a lot of what Rabbi included in our lesson today.
Yeah. Thank you, Ed. This is a good one. My Jewish Learning, by the way, myjewishlearning.com is a good resource, generally, not only with regard to the Musar movement, but with regard to issues generally. It's a good resource. Good, thanks, Ed. Anybody else before we go? Anyone? Well, this evening is the first night of Passover, so I hope that you have an opportunity to celebrate Passover this week, and it's always a little nicer to do it in person, particularly if you you employ the Sephardic practice of smacking each other with the green onions, right? That's not something that you can do over the computer. So it's something I would enjoy doing next Saturday night, but it's something I won't have the opportunity to do. But at any rate, I can pretend. So so we'll look forward to that. Just sign in at 5 o'clock like we normally do, using the same link, and we'll be sitting around our Seder table, okay? So God bless you guys. Good to see you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Rabbi. God bless everyone.
God bless you. Chag Pesach Sameach. Happy Passover. Yeah. Absolutely.
Take care. Happy birthday again, Batman.
Thank you. Bye for now.